It's time for From the Short Grass with Trey Shapp, a golf podcast for those who love golf, struggle with golf, and just like to enjoy the outdoors and fellowship with friends, all while chasing a ball around trying to put it in a 4 1/4 inch diameter hole. From the Short Grass is brought to you by Stevens Incorporated, an independent financial services firm with the freedom to focus on what matters most. And by Beachwood Pinnacle Hotels. We partner with you to deliver high-yield results by managing, developing, and investing in top-quality hospitality assets. And now, from the Short Grass, here is your host, Trey Shapp.
Welcome to another edition of From the Short Grass. I am your host, Trey Shapp. Last week, I introduced you to Maria Jose Marin, the 17-year-old freshman golfer at the University of Arkansas, who was competing in her second Augusta National Women's Amateur. She ended up finishing tied for 30th, but was able to play the hallowed grounds of Augusta National for the second straight year. Congratulations, Maria, on a great tournament. Coming up in this episode of From the Short Grass, I travel to St. Andrews, Scotland, and sit down with the former secretary and CEO of the RNA, Peter Dawson. He was the head of the Royal and Ancient from 1999 to 2015. More on him after the break. Beachwood Pinnacle Hotel Group, they know how to manage hotel properties. When you need an overnight place to stay, make sure you go on the web to bphotels.com and find one of their properties. You will be glad you did. Matthew Allen and Blair Allen, Beachwood Pinnacle Hotel Group. We are back after this. Stay with us. At Stevens, our philosophy is to invest every dollar as if it were our own. To seize opportunity. To anticipate rather than react. To deliver constant focus in an ever-changing world. And to pursue the objectives of our clients in order to help them reach their financial goals. A proven history of helping companies and individuals. Stevens, member NYSE SIPC.
Heading to El Dorado to check out some live music or to play Mystic Creek? Stay at the Haywood, the only boutique hotel in the middle of downtown and the Murphy Arts District. If you are spending a weekend in Hot Springs, make plans now at the Marriott Courtyard close to Lake Hamilton and Oaklawn. Beachwood Pinnacle Hotel Group manages both of these fine properties, and you will rest easy knowing that your every need is taken care of. Beachwood Pinnacle Hotels on the web at bphotels.com.
Welcome back to this edition of From the Short Grass. Last summer, I had a chance to take a trip to St. Andrews and the Old Course for the first time. It was magical. And while I was there, I had the pleasure of meeting Peter Dawson, the former secretary and CEO of the RNA and past president of the International Golf Federation. I spoke to him about joining me for a couple of episodes of From the Short Grass. And in January, we started working on a time to sit down. 2 weeks ago, I met with him in the boardroom of the Old Course Hotel just off the 17th fairway of the Old Course at St. Andrews. I hope you enjoy part one of my conversation with Peter Dawson. On the tee, Peter Dawson.
Mr. Dawson, thanks for joining me on From the Short Grass. It's a joy to be here with you in St. Andrews and overlooking the Old Course, a place that you saw almost every day for several years.
I did indeed. As secretary of the RNA and chief exec of its companies, I used to drive into the RNA car park when I was in town most mornings. And I got a buzz every day, you know, when I got out of the car. That was, it's real holy ground for golfers here.
I could still sense the buzz you get, because when we walked in here to the boardroom of the Old Course Hotel, just your eyes lit up as you looked out over the West Sands Beach and the course.
Yeah, I'm never tired of it. And we're up here on the top floor at the Old Course Hotel, right by the 17th fairway on the Old Course, looking across to the New and the Jubilee courses and to the beach and the sea beyond. Yeah, it's great golfing country. And, of course, the history of the game is so strong here. It's where golf began. I know there's some discussion about that here and there, but it's certainly where golf was developed. And 600 years ago, plus.
Do you remember the first time you ever picked up a golf club and fell in love with this game?
Well, I remember starting the game, and I was a schoolboy in Edinburgh here in Scotland, and I think there's over 40 golf courses or something in Edinburgh, and it's something kids do, and we lived about a half mile from a golf course, and I went along there and joined as a junior member with a chum of mine from school. And, you know, in those days, you won't believe this, but this was at about 1959 or 60. That's telling you how old I am. And a junior membership at Lothian Burn Golf Club, which I regret no longer exists, but a junior membership there in those days was £1 a year.
A year?
A year. Or 6 old pence a round, which is 2 new pence, roughly, for kids. And that's what golf development's all about. And that's why, so many kids play golf in Scotland. It's not as cheap as that now, but by international standards, golf remains very affordable here in Scotland.
Wow. Were you self-taught, or did you have a teacher or a pro?
I admit to being self-taught, which is showing through in my game these days. I think if I'd had more lessons, I'd be better at it. But I got to be quite a decent boy golfer and won a few things, and then went off to university at Cambridge and played for the Blues side for 3 years, captained it in my last year. We managed to beat Oxford each of the 3 years. And then played county golf for Essex, for Warwickshire, here in the UK. But I'd started work and a family. I got married quite young and so on. So the golf became a recreation as opposed to any kind of career in those days.
So did you ever think about turning professional?
I did, actually, when I was finishing school, but I was doing somehow reasonably well academically, and I'm certain I would have starved if I'd turned pro, so I took the education and then into business route, worked in manufacturing industry for many years.
How often did you get to play when you were working in manufacturing? I mean, did you still keep up playing?
Oh, yes, I kept playing, but it was very much a kind of once-a-week thing at the rush for quite a few years. And I must say, in those days when you had children, fathers tended to go out and play more golf, which is quite different to today. Quite the reverse applies. But I managed to keep the game going, and I always managed to separate my own golf from my job, even when I came to work in golf later in life. It was always a hobby and a pastime that was a great switch off.
What was the feeling you got the first time you stepped on the first tee of this old course?
Well, I remember it very well. I was up here with a business colleague back in the 70s, and we actually stayed in this hotel. It was only just the center portion of the hotel was built. And I remember looking out on the 17th famous hole, and I thought, I'm going to play this tomorrow. It was days of persimmon drivers and everything. And so I got to the 17th tee and hit a fantastic drive right down there. 4 iron to 6 feet. Knocked it 3 feet past and missed the one back.
Oh, no. So it was
a mixture of triumph and disaster, but loved it. I mean, I don't think I've played the old course, although quite a lot of people say this, as well since that first time, because mm-hmm. you don't know where the trouble is and you're a bit braver with everything and so on. But it's a truly unique golf course and an experience all golfers should have at some point.
Your favorite hole on this course, which one is it?
I have two. 17, of course, the famous one, and 14, the par 5 with Hell Bunker and all of those things on it. Since we put the new open tee further back of quite some years ago now, before a championship, that reintroduced a very difficult drive between the outer bounds on the right and the famous Beardy Bunkers on the left.
Mm-hmm.
And, it's one of the tough par fives in the world. And the state of the fairway, it's called the Elysian Fields here in St. Andrews, is the finest turf to hit a golf ball off I know anywhere.
What's the worst weather you've played this course in?
Oh, some phenomenal winds and driving snow at times.
Snow?
Yep, I've done that. And on days where getting the ball from the first tee over Granny Clark's wind was almost impossible, even with driver.
How did you get notified that you were going to replace Sir Michael Bonalack as Secretary of the RNA?
Well, I was a member of the RNA at that time. I'd been a member for maybe 4 years. And I was on the Rules of Golf Committee. And Michael Bonalack's retirement was announced. And a few people said to me, you should apply for this. And I said, don't be ridiculous. I've never worked in golf. Blah, blah, blah. And we lived in Northumberland, north of England, and my wife and I are very happy there. But nonetheless, I did get an application in right at the death. My son said to her, to his mother, "Oh, let him apply. He'll never get it. You know, don't worry." And and when I got to the last 12, well, things aren't quite going to plan here, James. "Don't worry, Mum. He'll never get it." And eventually, when I did get it, James wanted to know if the job was hereditary. But but of course, it wasn't. And my gosh, what a shock to get it, and what a privilege. And 16 years of 24/7 involvement was quite something. Loved every moment.
Did you feel at the time that you were ready for the task that was in front of you?
Well, I had in my business career run quite big companies and big organizations. So the people side of things and the commercial side of things were okay. You know, I was kind of accustomed to the big organization and all that went on, and the financial stuff and so on. The product, of course, the Open Championship and all the rest of it, very different from selling cranes or something that I might have been involved in the past. And what I found was very quickly that people in golf wanted me to succeed. It was a great environment to work in. People were very supportive, whereas in industry, being so competitive, you can bite your legs off if you're not careful. So it was a much more pleasant working atmosphere as well. And the motivation, you know, became, let's not let golf people down. Let's do this job right. And that was what drove me on, I guess.
How were you able to grow the Open Championship the way you were?
Well, if you look at the history of the championship from right way back in 1860, it's always grown, apart from war years and so on. You know, there's been a general growth trend. And we were able to make sure that it was a truly open. It was the most international of the majors. It had all the history. And when I joined, it perhaps needed a bit of commercial attention, which it received. And under Martin Slumbers, my successor, that's gone on in spades. I mean, they've really, really taken it forward as well. And I think attention to detail with the golf courses was very important. The players wanted the players to enjoy the experience. And it was a combination and a great team effort, of course, not just me, of lots of things. And I'm delighted to see the way it's grown again, you know, since my time. It's a really big event on the sporting calendar here now.
Do you think, obviously, televising and the fact that even in the States, you can watch from 2 in the morning all day long if you want to. Yeah.
Well, the time change can help or hinder, depending on which part of the world you live in.
Correct.
And, you know, we always had interesting discussions with Japanese television, very different to ones that you might have in America. But getting those major markets properly served by television coverage, America, Japan, Britain, etc., was very important. And it became a truly, it was watchable almost anywhere in the world. I think it allowed golf fans to see Lynx golf, which was something that they didn't actually experience very much on television. And the commentators were able to explain what that was all about, I think, particularly well, and increasingly well as television technology developed.
I think one guy that was, besides yourself, synonymous in my time with the Open Championship, and I know my daughter recognized it as well, was Ivor Robson.
Oh gosh, Ivor, yes, the
starter,
and the voice of the Open almost. He was an incredible guy. He would turn up very early in the morning, a good 40 minutes before the first tee time, make sure everything was ready, you know, and then he would stay out there all day. Even though we had starters gaps, he still didn't leave his post for natural breaks or anything like that. And he knew all the players, of course, because he was a starter on the European Tour as well. But his voice was one of the synonymous things about the Open. The other person that perhaps isn't seen all that often is the engraver. And the engraver at the Open Championship is a big deal. And my relationship with the engraver was always a tense one, you know, because there's always a pressure to get the closing ceremony started quickly for television purposes. So when to unleash the engraver was always a challenge. And we got to know each other pretty well as well.
That is seen on television today, the engraving of the claret jug. It has not always been done that way. So why the change? Why the look inside to that?
Well, that's quite a long-standing thing on television in the UK, for sure. The history of it is that in years gone by, it was the champion's responsibility to bring the claret jug back engraved. And in 1948, was it, or 47, Fred Daly had won at Hoylake. And he brought the claret jug back the following year, and it said Holy Lake on it. The engraver had got it wrong. But that the practice still continued. And then when Roberto De Vincenzo won at Hoylake, he forgot to have the trophy engraved. And that was the start of an engraver being called in the late 60s to do that. It became 100% about 3 years later. And a man called Alex Harvey was the engraver then. And when I started at the RNA in 99, Alex was still doing the job, and he was getting very elderly. And I sort of looked and I thought, gosh, I hope we don't lose Alex here. That would be a disaster. So I actually identified someone who would be able to stand in for Alex. I went down to London and found someone. But when I got back to the RNA, there was Alex in the club's trophy room engraving the club trophies with someone else helping him. And I said, who's that? Well, that's Alex's son, Gary. He can engrave as well. And Gary Harvey is a professional golfer here in Scotland. He won the British Boys Championship, age 17, and he engraved his own trophy then.
Oh, wow.
And Gary Harvey, lovely family. Gary, Alex has sadly died, but Gary Harvey still does the job today.
You spoke of tense moments of when to yep. unleash the graving yes. of yep. the claret jug. Yes. Has there ever been a thought of, well, maybe we need to hold back a little bit?
Oh, yes. I mean, he can do so much. He can put the venue in and he can put the, you know, some words in, like so many strokes and so on, but he can't put the name or the number until it's known. And of course, even if Tiger might be six shots ahead coming down the last, you have nightmares about a scorecard infringement or something. So I never took a risk.
Amateur golf has always had a place in the Open Championship, and you expanded the amateur pool of qualifiers at your time as Secretary of the RNA through the Asia-Pacific Amateur Championship and then the Latin American Amateur later. Why expand into those regions of the world?
Well, that was part of growing the game, really, you know, to try to give some aspirational impetus to growing the game in those parts of the world. And I'm delighted to see that that's now been extended to the new Africa Amateur Championship, played for the first time just a few weeks ago at Leopard Creek. And those championships are great events. We went into them in conjunction with the USGA and the Masters Tournament, Augusta National. And the exemptions are granted into those events as well. So it's a real incentive for good young players from those parts of the world to have a connection with the major championships in golf. And when you're developing the game, there's two things you have to do. You have to push from the bottom with development, and you also have to pull aspirationally from the top. And those championships were part of that latter part of the process.
Do you feel there's a good relationship with the USGA and the Masters Tournament?
Oh, yes.
Between the RNA?
Yeah, very good. Yeah, absolutely. I'm not that close to it now, of course. There certainly was in my time. We had a great relationship with all the other majors and the tours. And it was one of the things we had to work hard on early years. But I think it's fair to say there was quite a collegiate atmosphere by the time I finished. I'm not close enough to it now to comment.
Sure. What do you think about the Masters Tournament and what they're trying to do to grow the game with the drive, chip, and putt for the young kids, and then the introduction a couple of years ago of the Augusta Women's Amateur?
Well, it's great. It's wonderful what they're doing. And as I said, we worked closely with them. Billy Payne was the chairman at Augusta when he and I and others started up the Asia-Pacific Amateur and then the Latin America. And They were great to work with. Once you get an idea going at Augusta, they're tremendous implementers of something. They pour energy and finance into it and really get things done. They're very, very good to work with.
I've got to ask you about that place. From over here, where this is holy ground, St. Andrews and the Old Course, people in the States think that Augusta National is holy ground in the States.
Yeah, and it's earned its reputation. You know, it doesn't have the centuries of history that they have here, but since its foundation back in the, what, 30s?
30s.
It's gone from strength to strength and occupies a unique position in golf in America and indeed in golf in the world. The Masters Tournament is a truly iconic event. And all the majors, you know, have a different atmosphere. They have their own unique atmospheres, and the Masters is very different to the Open Championship. But both are great, great championships. And I don't think the organizers of the majors see each other as competitors. I think it's quite collegiate, which is a good thing.
Yeah, no doubt about that. As president of the International Golf Federation, you were instrumental in getting golf back as an Olympic sport in 2016 in Brazil. How were you able to accomplish that, and how important was it for the game of golf to be back in the Olympics?
Well, we had a couple of goes at it, and the first one was a pretty amateurish attempt some years earlier. But in 2009 in Copenhagen at the IOC session there, was when we made the final pitch and were voted on. The Olympic world works 7 years ahead, so 2009 got us in for 2016 in Rio. And the reason that we did it was not so much that professional golf needed it or anything like that, but that, you know, the smaller countries who were members of the International Golf Federation said to us, look, if golf was an Olympic sport, it would change the perception of golf in our country. It would give us more funding. It would give us more government support, etc. And I thought with others, well, you know, what better way is there to grow the game than get golf into the Olympics? Because it energized these smaller countries. And I think I'm right in saying that as a result of golf getting into the Olympics, something like 35 new national golf associations were formed around the world in smaller countries that didn't have one before. And, you know, that's tremendous grassroots impetus. And it took a while. I'm very pleased with the way the players now support it. The women players have always been very supportive. In Rio, not all of the top players came, but more in Japan and more next time, I'm sure.
Yeah, Paris coming up this summer.
Yeah, absolutely.
Will you be there for that?
I think I will. Yeah, I think I'll just as a visitor there. Because I retired from that presidency just before the Tokyo Olympics, and so that was my tenure.
Is that a feather in your cap that you might have? That hey, I was able to get the Olympics to recognize golf as a sport.
Well, just privately, yes, but we don't do legacy here. You know, it's just you're just renting space when you do jobs like this.
I understand. The RNA welcomed its first woman into the membership during your tenure. What was that timing like?
Well, it's been something that had an inevitability about it, I think, frankly. And the RNA, with its international governance role, certainly couldn't. It didn't have a good look or anything by being an all-male club on the east coast of Scotland, you know, trying to do this. Yeah, but on the other hand, you have a club and it has its members, and it's for the members to decide how they want their club to be. So there was a right time to do this, and we got the time right, I think. And now there are an increasing number of women members in the RNA and participating in the club and its events, and it's great to see.
Could you see in the future maybe a woman be secretary of the RNA?
Don't see why not. Time will tell, but I guess that has an inevitability about it too.
True. You're exactly right. You've been quoted as saying, golf is a very difficult game to dominate. Were you surprised at how Tiger Woods dominated this game for so long?
I don't know if I was surprised, but he certainly did that. And it is a difficult game to dominate. And his playing record, you know, his percentage of wins, I forget what the exact number is, was extraordinary. And, you know, Jack Nicklaus before him was not dissimilar. I think Jack probably, his winning percentages were high, but Jack's runner-up percentages were higher
very
still,
high,
I think.
Yes.
And both of those two guys dominated the game. But if you go back in time, you know, we've had these people, haven't we? We've had Tiger. We've had Jack Nicklaus. We've had, Ben Hogan, Arnold Palmer. You know, there's always been someone, and who knows who it is now? Is it Scotty Scheffler? I don't know, but by God, he can play.
Yes, he can. Yes, he can. He can play very well. What was it about Tiger when he came over here that it seemed to me like the crowds just flocked?
Yeah, he had an aura about him, and he looked so poised and athletic and wonderful golf swing and ability to strike the ball. And of course, so many players have modeled themselves on Tiger and Cups. The average standard of play today is higher than it was then. He stood out. But you could only be the best in your time, and my goodness, he certainly was. And I think he frightened a lot of the other players when they saw Tiger's name on the leaderboard. Knees began to knock, you know, and Tiger would go past them so often. But his ability to pull the shot that was needed out at just the right moment was extraordinary.
I think of Tiger in the Open win at Pebble Beach when he basically lapped the field maybe two or three times, where it was like after the first round, everybody knew they were playing for second.
Oh, absolutely. And, of course, the Open Championship here in 2000 was not dissimilar to that.
So right.
It was extraordinary. And he was in his pomp. And, of course, the way he won that first Masters tournament that he won, you know, after
97.
He shoot 40 on the front
shot 40
nine
on the front nine
of the first round. And everyone's saying, oh, look at that, he's gone. But by goodness me, he hadn't, had he? And goodness, that was, well, stuff of legend, really, isn't it? And so sad to see that his body hasn't been able to do it, and his accidents and so on. Got to be some story if he won again, wouldn't it?
It would be a story. It would be a great story if he won again. What about the 2002 Open Championship at Muirfield when he goes out and he shoots like 80-something,
yes,
and a storm just came out of nowhere? Oh, what do you remember that day?
Oh, yes. Could I ever forget it? It was probably the worst conditions we had on any day of an Open Championship, but they weren't bad enough to stop play. You could still play golf. The balls weren't rolling away on the greens, and it was the temperature dropped, I don't know, 20 or 30 degrees Fahrenheit in minutes. It was extraordinary. And this squall came in, which was not forecast by the weather people.
Right.
It sort of built up locally in the area.
Mr. Dawson, I've always said weather forecasters get paid to be wrong.
Well, I can cite you many stories of weather forecasters who've been badly wrong at an Open Championship, and I was quite famous for belittling them after years. But anyway, that's another story. You know, Ernie, who won that championship, mm-hmm, he was out in the same weather, and he didn't win it because he was out in the good part of the day. He had to go through it too, I think, from memory. And we had a four-way playoff that year. It
that's
was
right.
Quite something, yeah.
But Tiger did shoot a 66
the next day.
He came
back with a tremendous round, yeah.
Impressive.
Heading to El Dorado to check out some live music or to play Mystic Creek? Stay at the Haywood, the only boutique hotel in the middle of downtown and the Murphy Arts District. If you are spending a weekend in Hot Springs, make plans now at the Marriott Courtyard close to Lake Hamilton and Oaklawn. Beachwood Pinnacle Hotel Group manages both of these fine properties, and you will rest easy knowing that your every need is taken care of. Beachwood Pinnacle Hotels on the web at bphotels.com.
That's all the time we have on this episode of From the Short Grass. I want to thank Mr. Peter Dawson for the invitation to sit down with him at the Old Course Hotel in St. Andrews and bring you part one of my sit down with him. Part two comes your way next week. It's another one that you will not want to miss. I hope you enjoyed part one of my sit down with Mr. Dawson. I really think you're going to enjoy the second part as well. It's Masters Week. Who do you have slipping on the green jacket on Sunday afternoon? Will it be a repeat winner and like a Scottie Scheffler? Can John Rahm go back-to-back in winning green jackets in consecutive years? Will Zalatoris finally slip on a green jacket? Will Tiger Woods make the cut and play well? Might he win another green jacket this year? It's all yet to unfold. I want to thank our sponsors, Beachwood Pinnacle Hotel and Stevens, for their continued support of From the Short Grass. Remember, when you find your ball mark on the green, fix it and a couple of more. I hope to see you sometime soon, very soon, from the Short Grass.
You've been listening to From the Short Grass, a weekly podcast dedicated to the game of golf. This has been a presentation of the Buzz Radio Network.